Okay, so I would like to start by, of course, thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to be here and give this talk. It's always a pleasure to visit Santa Barbara. And secondly, part of the reason that I'm standing here before you talking today about ITC is actually due to one of the members of in the audience. I think it was three years ago that Hartmut Munin gave a talk, or actually he gave a mini course in a winter school at the Weizmann Institute in Israel, during which at some point he made a comparison or drew the analogy between the centrifugal of ITC and Jurassic Park. Both, he said, are full of old dinosaurs. So I'm not, I couldn't find the dinosaurs, and I'm not sure that I will leave any long-lasting impression on the field. I mean, of course, I mean, for those of you who didn't get the point, I mean, the point was to try and to encourage young people to go into the field and make fresh contributions. But
get eaten alive.
And get eaten alive, that's true. But what I did find is that the problem is extremely interesting, and I would like to thank him for that. So, actually, this is the title of my talk. And here are my collaborators. I think Steve and Vic don't need an introduction here. Erica Carlson is a former student of Steve. And I will also show you data taken in ZX's group, especially by Xinjiang Zhu. Okay, so I'd like to start with what I called my ideological transparency. And I would like to pose the question, why should we study quasi one-dimensional models? And I offer you here two possible answers to this question. One, which is more theoretically motivated, is the fact that these are models that can be solved or almost solved or solved in some controlled approximation and can be used to study strongly correlated physics that is of much interest this day. I try to give here a more experimentally motivated reason to study these models, and this is the fact that in particular the high temperature superconductors exhibit very abnormal properties in what usually is referred to as their normal state and also in their superconducting phase. And moreover, there is evidence that they show strike correlations both in the normal and the superconducting phases. This doesn't mean, of course, that one-dimensional physics is the most important physics in the context of ITC, but it gives us some kind of hope that it is. So, in a sense, this is the plan of my talk. I'm going to introduce a model and do my best to solve this model. And throughout the talk, I'll try to motivate the model and contrast the results, its results or its properties with the high temperature superconductors. Okay? So let me first introduce the model. The model is a model of weakly Josephson coupled spin gap one-dimensional electron gases. So here, I mean, I'm sure that it's familiar for most of the members of the audience. I have the one-dimensional chains. Each of them is either a Luttinger, gapless Luttinger liquid, or it can be a Luther-Emery liquid in the sense that its spin sector is gapped. I will assume that these one-dimensional chains are far enough from half filling, so I don't have to worry about Umlaut scattering. But I will introduce this term basically at least on that level as a phenomenological term that will produce for me a spin gap. There is a microscopic reasoning behind this 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 term, which I will not introduce. But that can be, I mean, this term can be argued for from microscopic. And then I'm going to Johnson couple them. Namely, I'm going to introduce pair hopping between the chains, and I will assume that this is the most relevant coupling between the one-dimensional systems. It's not an obvious statement to make. I can comment on this point later if you wish me to. So this is
what's the indices on size?
Okay, good. So I will introduce them. I mean, I will introduce the notation for psi later. But the first index here tell you whether this is associated with a left or right moving electron, and this is the spin. And I, J are the chain index. Okay, what I'm going to do in the context of the couplets, if you wish, is to march along this line from high temperature into the superconductor. So I will start considering this model at the high temperature phase, where both the spin gap and the coupling between the chains can be ignored. And then I will successively introduce the spin gap and the Johnson coupling and see what happens. So I would like to start by flashing this this transparency, and the point of this transparency is not to go over it in detail, but to leave you with the general impression, I hope, that stripes are ubiquitous in both in the superconducting the high temperature superconductors, the cuprates, in some of its relative non-superconducting materials, like the neodymium doped LSCO. Actually, this for 0.4 neodymium doping, this still superconduct, but if you dope it to 0.6, it becomes an ordered stripe material. And also in relatives of these family, namely the nickelates and the manganates. There is evidence both for spin and charge stripes coming from various experimental techniques. Again, I'm not going to go over it in detail, but I think it's obvious, but just by looking at this this table, it's obvious that stripes are there. I mean, the question is whether or not they are essential for high temperature superconductivity. I mean, we would like to take the point of view that they are, but it's not obvious at all.
Can we discuss this point later, or
I mean, this is in part one of the purposes of this talk. I would like to initiate a discussion, but I have many things to tell you, so let's postpone it. Okay, so let's go back to theory and contrast the properties of this simple model. Remember, now I'm considering basically an isolated one-dimensional chain, because I'm considering now the high temperature where both the spin gap and the coupling between the chains can be ignored. Remember, I'm starting marching from high temperature down. And the most fundamental thing that you see there is a strike difference and I'm going to concentrate now on the spectral function of this material, between the spectral function of this model and the spectral function of the familiar Fermi liquid. Why? I mean, a fundamental property of the Fermi liquid is that the quantum numbers of its elementary excitations are similar to that of an electron. This immediately implies that when you look at the spectral function for a hole, in this case, in a Fermi liquid, you would find a sharp peak, a sharp quasi-particle peak, and this quasi-particle is defined, if you like, by the property that its width its decay time is much smaller than its typical binding energy. This peak is immersed in a multi-quasi-particle background, and when you look at the spectral function, or when you look at this peak, so for an ideal Fermi liquid, this is of course a delta function. Once you introduce this order, for example, this peak would be smeared. The point is that the width of the peak in omega is related to the width of the peak in k along the k direction here via the Fermi velocity. Now, a very, very different thing happens in a Latouche liquid. Why? Because in a Latouche liquid, the electron is unstable towards the decay into the elementary excitations of this system, which come, as it turns out, in four flavors. They can be left-right moving, and they can be of either charge or spin. When you look at the consequences of that, just kinematics now, you find this picture. So there is no longer any peak, any quasi-particle peak in A of K and omega. Instead, you have this broad distribution. And what you should notice here is basically that the width of the K width of the distribution is determined by the kinematics. So these, I mean, this shape of the support of this spectral function is basically kinematics. And as you see here, once you shut down decay channels into one or more of these elementary excitation of the Latouche liquid, you progressively lose area in this support of the spectral function. So for example, if I look here at the right moving hole, once I do not allow any more decay to left spin excitations, I lose this part of the spectral function, and so forth and so forth. When you look at the what is known as the EDC, or let's start with the MDC. When you look at the MDC, which is basically a cut of constant omega at of the spectral function, you see these figures. This is the momentum distribution curve. Thanks. And, okay, I'll reintroduce it in a second. So this is the momentum distribution curve. It's exactly what I just said. I mean, just a cut through A of K and omega fix omega. What you see here, that this is basically insensitive to the strength of the interaction in the one-dimensional electron gas, which is given here. And it always shows a peak around zero wave vector at the Fermi energy. I measure both energy, I measure energy from the Fermi energy and K from K Fermi. So the width, what I'm trying to say here is that the MDC is basically given by kinematics.
No, but this picture for the support of this function is really true for zero temperature.
I'm talking about zero temperature, of course. I mean, temperature will smear the boundaries here, but that's it. Now, contrary to the MDC, the EDCs can look very different and depending on the strength of the interaction in the system. Basically, they are determined by dynamics. They are determined by the overlap or the matrix elements for processes in which the hole decays into the various excitations of the Latouche liquid. And it can be peaky or very, very flat as a function of the interaction strength. As you can see here, as I increase the interaction, I lose the peak in the EDC. So the reason that this took place is the fact that the hole fractionalized into the elementary excitation of the Latouche liquid. I want to make the point, I mean, this is a very popular notion these days, fractionalization, I mean. And I want to make the point that it doesn't really necessarily mean charge spin separation. There are other examples where the electron fractionalizes, but that don't involve charge spin separation. And I give you several examples here. For example, the spinless one-dimensional electron gas is fractionalized. You just eliminated two flavors, if you wish, of the elementary excitation, but it still fractionalizes into a left and right density wave, left and right moving density waves. Another possibility is whenever you have topological order in your system. One example is, of course, the fractional quantum Hall effect, where the Hall or electron, never mind, decays into, say, three E over three quasi-particles. Again, the thing can be spin-polarized and it still fractionalizes. As a result, by the way, the edges of this fractional quantum Hall state, which is now a chiral spinless Schlattinger liquid, so you have only one flavor in this liquid, so apparently there can be no fractionalization, is still fractionalized. And this is because it remembers somehow that the ground state has this non-trivial property, which I call here topological order. I can explain technically where the difference comes from, but I mean, I don't think this is, I should elaborate here. I mean, Santiago and Matthew recently proposed this, these Z2 gates theories to describe a family of strongly correlated systems, where there is a possible phase which is topologically ordered and fractionalized. In their case, fractionalization actually does mean spin charge separation. And finally, Sajdev proposed this model for nodal quasi-particles that are scattered off quantum critical fluctuations, and it exhibits a similar property. So,
what's fractionalized?
Okay, I take the point of view that fractionalization is a property of a system is fractionalized whenever it has a zero overlap between the state that is created by the physical Hall operator or the physical electron operator and one of its elementary excitations, single particle, if you like, elementary excitation. Okay? Now, where the Z factor, is zero.
But so all quantum critical points
It's all quantum critical points, exactly.
And everything.
Right.
Local operators.
Okay, so let's go back to experiment now. Here I show you ARPAS data taken on BISCO by the Brookhaven group. And what they plotted here is exactly what I plotted before in the let's call it the theoretical transparency. Okay, let's start with the bottom figure, where they plot MDCs, momentum distribution curve. Remember, this is a cut in LFK and omega for fixed omega, and EDCs, so MDCs and EDCs, and on various cuts through the Fermi surface. So let's concentrate, say, on cut number three here. You see that while the MDC exhibits a well-defined nice peak, the EDC is basically featureless. Consider when you look at this this figure, you should concentrate on the high temperature, namely the normal state data here. You see that something happens across TC that I will deal with later on in this talk. So there's definitely an evidence in experiment for a dichotomy between sharp NDCs and flat featureless EDCs, at least in BISCO in the anti-nodal direction around here, around pi zero. Here you look at the spectral function, it's not very clear, it's this is the usual picture of apparently for the antinodal region. It's very noisy, but you see that there is no apparent peak in this data. It's smeared. Something happens when you cross into the superconductor. You see these sharp peaks appearing here. And I will tell you something about the appearance or the properties of these peaks later on.
Are we supposed to view the... What's your point of view on the background?
Yeah. Which background?
I mean, if I look at the data on the bottom left,
right,
the EDCs,
any of this those, one.
Yeah. I guess you're making the point that there's a less obvious peak there than on the right, but I guess the experimentalists are telling us that the background on the left is somehow extrinsic, or at least. So would there be more of a peak there if I somehow subtracted that off?
Maybe. I don't know. I can't tell. But maybe, let me show you a better state of data that might at least partially answer your question. So this is, these are measurements. What I want to show you next is actually, so what I wanted to show you here is that at least in the antinodal direction in BISCO, there is clear evidence that something unusual is taking place, namely in the normal state of BISCO. There is no well-defined quasi-particle peak in the data, and the data seems, I mean, the spectral function is smeared, the EDCs are featureless, the MDCs on the other end are sharp. I will show you next data on a very different material, or a related material, which is neodymium doped LSCO. This thing. It's 0.6 neodymium doped, so it's a non-superconducting relative of the LSCO. This is a material in which there is strong evidence for static stripe order. Recently, ZX group found out that when you look at the spectral function, or rather here they show you N of K, the integrated spectral function over frequencies or energies of about 0.5 EV from, or actually here I show you a much, here I show you a different thing. Here I show you A of K and omega, which is integrated to within 30 MeV from the Fermi energy. So what you see here is basically the low energy weight in the spectral function of LNSCO and LSCO, both with doping of 0.15%. You see these nice, I mean, one-dimensional looking patches around the antinodal directions here, but which we would like to associate with stripes that run in this direction or in that direction. But on top of that, you see a nodal segment here, a nodal segment that runs from the end of this patch to the end of that patch, where there seems to be a low energy weight.
I'm confused. You said at 0.6, this is an insulator or what?
Yeah, I mean, this particular material is neodymium doped LSCO with a concentration of neodymium that turns it into a stripe ordered phase, which is non-superconducting and insulating.
So what are these low energy excitations? Is there a Fermi surface or what?
Well, there is a Fermi crossing, if you in the sense that there are low energy excitations that are concentrated along this line. So you look at A of K and omega. A of K and omega is a function of K and omega. And you ask yourself, where do I have low energy excitation? So where do I have spectral weight at small energies and in this function? So this is what is plotted here.
But let me see, as a theorist, should I think about it as a mode insulator or localized insulator or what? I mean,
Right, it's, I mean, this is a, all right, we would like to think about it as a semantic phase of a semantic stripe phase. This is an ordered stripe material.
But experimentally, it's non-superconducting.
It is non-superconducting.
It's still metallic. Will you call it as an insulator?
You're saying insulator.
Resistivity as you go to low temperature.
It is metallic. I mean, this particular, no, you're right. I mean, it is, this particular, you're right, this particular compound is metallic.
So what's the wave vector of the ordering?
Point, okay, so from here you can estimate,
what's the unit cell, I guess?
It's four lattice constants.
So why is the, you know, why don't I see ordering of the unit cell?
It's not apparent in this view graph, but there is evidence actually that I don't have it here, but if you integrate A of K and omega to higher energies from the Fermi surface, you actually see some structure with the expected periodicity along this direction. Does this answer your question?
Am I right in expecting that it should be, the unit cell in reciprocal space should be a quarter of the size?
Right, so this is what you see. This is, okay. So what you see here, I mean, the width of this distribution is basically related to the filling of, if you believe in this interpretation in terms of one-dimensional stripes, then the width here is related to the filling of this one-dimensional stripes. Okay? This is the these are the Fermi wave vectors of the stripes that run in this direction.
You're not scattering off the density, I guess.
I don't know. But
the
quasi momentum would only be defined modulo, or is it the lattice vector of the form factor?
Maybe
the form factor is just.
I mean, for example, the reason why you don't have a spectral weight around the gamma point is presumably associated with form factors. Okay, so you can ask the question, why don't I see, if these are stripes, why don't I see stripes all over the place? And presumably this is due to, at least partially due to form factors. Okay, so, I mean, contrary to the antinodal region where I have a microscopic justification for applying stripes ideas or stripe physics in order to understand what they observe, I don't really have a good justification for the nodal direction. But let me take a heuristic point of view and compare the two nevertheless.
What happens if they change the 30 MeV cutoff they use in the integral?
If they increase the cutoff, say to 500 MeV, then you get something that resembles a cross. So you get a Fermi surface that is basically composed out of two straight segments that one possible interpretation is just due to stripes that run along the vertical and horizontal directions. And they of course see the weight along the nodal direction as indicated here. Maybe I have a picture of. Here. So this is what they see when they integrate to 500 or 400 MeV. Okay, so as I said, let me take a heuristic point of view and compare the experimental spectral function along the nodal direction as you see here. With the one-dimensional gapless Luttinger liquid prediction. So again, as in the case of the of Bisco, in the case of the antinodal direction in Bisco, The MDCs are sharp and peak, relatively sharp and peak. The EDCs are flat and featureless. And moreover, it seems that the details, for some reason, which I admit I don't understand, from a microscopic point of view, agree quite nicely. And here, the parameters that are used in order to fit the data are listed up there, and they seem reasonable. This spin is 0.7 electron volt angstrom, which is close to the spin wave velocity that is measured in the undoped materials. V charge is something like five times this velocity, and this is in the right ballpark if you expect the ratio to be of the order of T over J, say. We look at the spin rotation invariant latitude liquid, so gamma s equals to zero and gamma c equals 0.5, which indicates strong interactions. Now, it's not clear, if you look for a microscopic model that will give you such strong interactions, the Hubbard model, for example, even in its infinite U limit, will only produce gamma c, which is which equals 1/1/8. However, by introducing some short range or nearest neighbor repulsive interactions in the model, you can push easily gamma c to this regime. Okay, so let's go back to theory now. And now I want to cross the phase, I go on marching along this line in the phase diagram, and I want to go into the spin gap phase. So now I have to include the relevant cosine term that produces for me this spin gap. The nice thing about these one-dimensional models is that you can actually solve them. And this is one example where you can actually calculate the spectral function in the model, which is not a trivial task. I mean, technically, what you do, you refermionize the spin sector of this model, and since Ks equals 1/2 is a fixed point of this model, I will choose to work at the fixed point, namely fix Ks to be 1/2, in which case the refermionized model is non-interacting, as you well know. So the spectrum, obtaining the spectrum is then trivial. The tricky point is calculating correlation functions. And this is more tricky because they involve what are called vertex operators. So when you, for example, try to write down the single Hall correlation function in terms of these pseudo fermions that you introduced in order to rewrite this model, you find that you can't do that just with the fermions. You have to introduce non-local fields in the fermionic fields, and this complicates your life. Well, actually, you can do quite well with simple consideration without going into the full calculations, but I will show you the results maybe in steps. From kinematics, that's because the model is massive at this point. You know that the spectral function should have a delta function peak plus a multi-soliton continuum. Actually, you can get, we are interested in calculating this Z factor, and you can do quite well by this simple scaling argument. So I want to find the dependence of the Z of K on the spin gap scale, delta S. So how do I do that? It's a simple argument. You know the dependence of GS on the cutoff, the ultraviolet cutoff, when delta S equals to zero. I mean, it's obvious that this can be affected by the opening of the gap, because this comes from the high energy physics. So I know that this dependence should not change when I open a spin gap. Now, GS is the part of the spin part of the correlation function, of the single hole correlation function. Okay, the charge part is still trivial because it's the gapless, the gapless charge modes are still there, and they are the, I mean, the charge part of the Lagrangian Hamiltonian did not change.
So I'm supposed to convolve this?
With yeah, you just convolve them, exactly. I mean, the tricky part is calculating the spin part of the whole correlation function. So let me go back to the scaling argument. So I know that the lambda scaling of Z should be the same regardless of whether or not I have a spin gap. Now, just by pure dimensional analysis, I then find that Z depends on Xi, the spin correlation length, in this manner, times some scaling function which is unknown. Actually, if you press the machinery hard enough, you can calculate this scaling function by using known results on the form factors of these vertex operators. I mean, the technicalities are not important here. The point is that you can do that, and the important outcome is that nothing really changes. The spectral function and the corresponding MVCs and EDCs for different interaction strength look basically the same as the gapless case. The difference, of course, is that everything is shifted by the spin gap here, and there are some minor details. You get some muted singularities when at the threshold for multi-particle processes.
So this is the full Green function.
This is the full Green function. This is unfair convolution with the charge sector.
So the charge sector gives all the smearing.
Exactly. Right? Yeah, exactly.
So what's the justification for not having the spin-ons interacting with the charge Luttinger liquid?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, I guess in general, if I have some massive particle around, no reason it can't at least have something like a density-density interaction with any other particle that's around. I mean, I guess I'm thinking of Fermi-edge singularity kind of physics. I mean, you're doing a more subtle problem, but if you just had a simpler problem of just an ordinary, just a spinless Luttinger liquid, and
right.
then some other gapped branch of excitation.
You could have coupled them.
And in general, there would be some coupling. And the spectral function for this gapped thing naively would have a delta function in it, but any arbitrary amount of coupling, because of this kind of Fermi edge singularity physics, generally smears that out, even without this convolution physics. I mean, I guess in a gapless Luttinger liquid, there are reasons, kinematic reasons, why low energies decouple, but that's usually not the case when you have a massive branch of excitations.
Do they want to be in a situation where the spin gap is really small compared to the...
Yeah, so that's what I'm wondering. You're invoking some kind of extra crossover scale to throw that out, or...
Yeah. Yeah, in general, you can have such a coupling. I agree, and you will have to introduce some crossover energy scale or temperature in order to justify neglecting.
Basically, this would come from some terms which are irrelevant in the
Luttinger liquid.
Exactly. But could come back and screw things up.
I agree. I mean, as I said, I choose to work at the fixed point and neglect any possible irrelevant operators that are certainly there.
Which is sort of valid in the limit that the spin gap is going to zero
is,
prior.
Right.
That's the scaling function, they're assuming that implicitly too.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so the basic message here is that whatever I showed you before, is true whether or not you have a spin gap in your system or not. I mean, this general dichotomy between sharp NDC and sharp and flat broad EDCs, they exist both in the gap and the spin gap phase. So up to this point, I covered this part in the if you wish of the phase diagram. I considered the spinless case, the spin gap phase, and let's now cross the boundary into the superconductor and see what happens there. So experimentally, I already showed you that something is happening there. I mean, these sharp quasi-particle light peaks appear in the spectral function. So let's concentrate on them because they are the most prominent features that one sees when one crosses the phase boundary. And here is a measurement of this peak in optimally doled disco by the Brookhaven group, and you see how it turns on around the TC. So what are the properties of this peak? It turns on near TC, as I just said. There is hardly dispersion when you move along the Fermi surface. Here is basically what you see here is the intensity of A of K and omega, basically a part of A of K and omega near the Fermi vector at the Antonova direction in Bisco. So you see that it hardly disperses with K parallel to the Fermi surface. Its energy and lifetime hardly changes with temperature. What is strongly temperature dependent is the spectral weight under this peak. So here is the spectral weight under this peak as a function of both temperature, so here's TC, and doping. So this is the spectral weight let's call it zero temperature, as function of doping. And you see that both resembles quite nicely the behavior of the superfluid density as a function of doping and temperature. This is taken, the superfluid density here is taken from BISCO and YBCO, so it's not exactly the same system. I mean, also this BISCO is not exactly the same system as the one that was measured here, but I mean, the similarities, I think, are apparent.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Your dubious transparency.
Sure.
How does it follow from your model that there won't be any dispersion?
I will address this question. So let's go into the superconducting state now, within the model I introduced. Now I have to deal seriously with the interchain coupling. And I start by bosonizing them. And one thing I would like to note here is that even by looking at the superconducting order parameter, it's quite suggestive to write it this way, since you see it seems that the amplitude of the order parameter is given by the spin degrees of freedom, while the phase is given by the charges. So this is the model of this approach. There is some due to the existence of a preformed spin gap, there is some kind of pairing going on above TC. But the fact that you are living on one-dimensional systems lead to strong fluctuations of this of the phase of this order transfer, which is associated with the charges, and this prevents you from going into a true superconductor. But nevertheless, the amplitude of this order parameter, which is associated with the spins that are gapped, is finite. So how am I going to deal with this problem now? I can solve it exactly, but I can do the best next thing, which is to do controlled approximations to solve it. So I'm going to continue to treat the one-dimensional physics exactly. But I'm going to take this coupling, the Johnston coupling between them, between the one-dimensional chains, in mean field theory, or in mean field approximation. And this was shown to be a reasonable approximation by Doug here, Imri, and Pincus way ago, in the early 70s, I think. And this is, I mean, this is my naive way of looking at this approximation, or the validity, the condition for the validity of this approximation. You want that you have one-dimensional superconducting correlations in your one-dimensional system, which extend over a large enough range within this this one-dimensional system compared, say, to the spacing between neighboring chains. I mean, in more precise terms, what you actually want is that TC should be large compared to the Johnston coupling between neighboring chains, and this can be shown to be correct or hold in the model that I'm solving. I will show it to you on the next transparency. So I will apply this mean field approximation, and the meaning of applying a mean field approximation in this context is to replace the multi-chain problem with a single chain problem. So I'm going to replace one of these order parameters by its expectation value. And here is the result. H now, the single chain Hamiltonian is the old charge part, the spin part, which is spin gap, I remind you, and this term, which comes from replacing one of the deltas by its expectation value. Now, this is the beginning of the good news. Why? Because this term couples for us spins and charges. In order to have any chance in producing a quasi-particle peak, we have to have some way of binding together the independent one-dimensional spin and charge excitations. So this at least gives us a hope that it will eventually produce such binding or confinement. To give you further evidence that there is such hope, I'd like to consider what is the effect of operating with this hole creation operator on whatever state you have for the one-dimensional system. The point to note here is that this operator is basically a shift operator for both the charge field Fs and the spin field Fs and the charge field theta c. This is just due to the fact that phi and the derivative of theta are canonically conjugated. So you don't have to pay attention to any of the details here, except for remembering the fact that whenever I operate with psi on the state of my system, I shift psi at point x, I shift by square root pi over 2 the fields phi s and theta c from the point x to the left. So hole operators create both charge and spin square root pi over 2 kings. Let's look what happens, or what are the consequences of these two relevant cosine terms that we have now in our effective Hamiltonian. When I look at the number, the total number of spin solitons and the total number of charged solitons in the system, and here, by the way, I have to say something about the meaning of charge in the system. I mean, the charge is not really defined. We are in a superconducting state. It turns out that the meaning of charge in this context is actually chirality, or in more physical terms, it's the way this particle or quasi-particle couples to a magnetic field. So NC, while NS, the number of spin solitons, basically measures for you the spin of the state in units of h bar over 2, the number of charged solitons is basically the difference between the number of right-moving electrons and left-moving electrons in your system. Now, since we have two relevant cosine terms in our theory now, it means that on one hand, this spin gap term determines NS to be an integer, while the Josephson coupling term, or the mean field version of this term, means that NS plus NC equals an even integer. If you combine them together, you get that the allowed sectors of your Hilbert space contain states with usual quantum numbers. They are actually, well, you can find a state, say, with E equals 1, I mean, charge 1 and spin 1 half, or a neutral state with spin 1, or something that looks like a Cooper pair. But it seems that all the exotic exotic quantum numbers of the one-dimensional phase are gone. This again gives us hope that the one-dimensional excitations that were free and independent in the one-dimensional gapless and spin gap case are actually confined once you go into the superconductor. And in a second, I will actually show you how the dynamics works. I mean, how this actually takes place. So before I do that, I'd like to spend a second considering the zero spin soliton sector. So in the case where I don't have any spin solitons in the system, but the charges are free to do what they want. Since I assume that the temperature is much more than the spin gap, I can assume appropriately that the spins are frozen and replace this cosine by its expectation value at zero temperature, basically. I can then basically repeat the thing I did for the spin gap case, namely refermionize the charge Hamiltonian, and I end up with this refermionized version, which is again easy to solve at the point KC equals 1/2. And again, since this is now a fixed point of this theory, I will choose to work at this particular point. The resulting Hamiltonian is basically a BCS-like Hamiltonian. I mean, the difference between this case and the spin gap case is that in the spin gap case, I had the mass term. In this situation, the mass term turns into basically a BCS term. And not surprisingly, everything leads to a BCS-like results. In particular, I get a BCS-like gap equation with these familiar results. The thing to notice here, there are two things to note here. One is that if you remember the condition on for the validity of the mean field approximation, you can actually easily check that this result for delta, for the charge gap, actually validates the assumption that we made at the beginning. The more important thing to note is that there is this simple relation between TC and the charge gap. So the moral of this calculation is the following. This model has two scales. One, the spin gap scale, delta S, which is basically unaffected by superconductivity. The second one, which is, as you see here, basically TC, is set by the onset of charge coherence in the system. So let's go on and consider the most interesting case in the superconducting sector, which is the case where you have one hole in your one-dimensional system. So you actually have one spin and one charge anti-solitons. The result is that Johnson coupling, and I will explain the physics in a second, the result is that Johnson coupling does lead to confinement of both charge and spin these charge and spin solitons. Why? The physics is very simple. Since the Johnson coupling wants the order parameter to have the same sign on neighboring chains, I assume, say, that the sign of delta on each of the chains is 1. This is the way to minimize this term in the Hamiltonian. Now, remember that I told you that whenever I create a soliton, either spin or charge, I shift phi s or theta c by square root power over 2. Since delta is proportional to this combination, you can easily convince yourself that once I cross such a soliton, either charge or spin, it doesn't matter, the sign of delta changes from, say, 1 to minus 1. This is just because I shift either phi s or theta c by square root power over 2. So if I create a hole, as a result I create one charge and one spin soliton, say, on this chain. Let's march from the right and see what happens to delta. So delta is 1 here. Once I cross the charge soliton, it changes sign. This sign change is healed once I cross the second soliton. So as a result, I end up with a wrong sign of delta at the region between the spin and charge solitons. This leads to actually a linear confining potential between charge and spin solitons, and actually it works between any type of solitons or anti-solitons, charge or spin. The result will be a bound state of these two solitons, which will have now a finite overlap with the state created by the physical hole operator, and this will show up as a finite spectral weight to a quasi-particle like peak. So these are the words. You can actually calculate it, and the way you do it is by using the adiabatic approximation. If I assume, as I do, that the spin gap is much larger than the charge gap, the spin degrees of freedom are now slow, and I can fix them and solve the charges on the background of the spin soliton. Technically, that means that I would like to solve the previous charge Hamiltonian that I showed you, the refeminized version of this charge Hamiltonian, but now in the presence of the spin soliton or anti-soliton. This means that delta has this non-trivial x dependence. It's basically a step at the position of the spin soliton RS. Now it's easy to transform this problem into what is known as the polyacetylene problem, which was solved in the early 80s, which is basically a non-interacting problem for Dirac fermions on the background of such a soliton. And this is the result. the most important result in that particular problem is the existence of a mid-gap state. So without the spin soliton, this is your spectrum. It's basically a gap, a massive Dirac spectrum. Once you introduce the spin soliton, you find that there is an extra state here exactly at zero energy. This is called the mid-gap state. And this is, as you can show, is the bound charge to spin soliton state. The energy of this state is basically the energy that it takes to create such a spin soliton, plus the difference in the occupied valence bands here. And you can calculate it, and in this limit at least, where delta S is much larger than delta C, you find, and in this case also what you get is that the shape of this soliton is sharp. So you solve basically a problem of charged Dirac fermions on the background of a step function. That is what you find. The energy of the of this state is delta S plus delta C over 2, which is basically delta S, since this is much larger than that. Now, the nice thing about this solution is that if you remember the super selection rules that I showed you before, coming from the two relevant cosine terms, whenever you have a spin soliton, so whenever NS equals 1, these selection rules requires that in terms of the pseudo fermions that I introduced in order to solve this problem, their number should be half integer. So since this relation holds, so the number of this pseudo fermions that I introduced in order to solve this this game is actually nc over 2, and this should be half integer according to these rules. And the nice thing is that this is exactly what you get. This is a special property of these spin gap mid gap state. So everything seems to fall into place here. So let me enumerate the properties of this bound state that we just found. Again, from kinematics, I know then that I should have a bound state, a delta function in my spectral function with some weight and a multi-particle or multi-soliton continuum. Epsilon, the energy of this state, is basically the creation energy that I just described to you, and just by boosting the solution that I found, I get this the dependence on the parallel momentum. Up till now, I neglected any tunneling between neighboring chains in the transverse direction. I can do that with this result. So it's basically tight binding with one important difference. T perpendicular is renormalized by exactly this spectral weight. The last thing I can say is that, again, by applying a similar scaling argument to the one that I used when I described the result for the spin gap case, I can actually calculate the dependence of this spectral weight on delta C or xi C, which is the charge coherent length. And I get this, again, power law dependence. So what are the properties of this state? Its peak energy is weakly dependent. It goes from delta S at TC to delta S plus delta C over 2 at T equals to 0. Since this is much larger than that, the change is small. spectral weight, though, is the most important property of this state is that its spectral weight is strongly dependent on temperature. It is some fractional power of delta C, which can be shown to be related to the superfluid density. Actually, the superfluid density is proportional to delta C. The dispersion in parallel direction, I mean the direction along the stripes in this model, it disperses basically with the spin velocity. While in the perpendicular direction, the dispersion is very weak due to the assumption also of weak tunneling, but it's also suppressed with this factor Z. So we would expect that the dispersion should know about TC as well. And there might be some vague experimental indication that this is the case, as indicated in the work by Balatsky and Chen in the Nature paper. But it's well within experimental errors.
What's NS of T? Sorry, that's the...
This is the superfluid density of the...
Along the chain?
No, this is the two-dimensional superfluid density. So this is basically... Okay, so this is basically a system of stripes that runs in different directions. So if you assume that you have a distribution, an even distribution of stripes that go in one direction and in the other, you can actually calculate the macroscopic two-dimensional superfluid density. And it turns out to be the geometric average of the superfluid density along the stripes and the perpendicular direction. So along the stripe, this is basically the phase stiffness of the one-dimensional chain. So it's basically K charge.
What comes in here, NS, theoretically is
NS is the square root of KC, which is the phase stiffness, sorry, of the one-dimensional chain, times the phase stiffness of in the perpendicular direction. Now this phase stiffness is proportional to TC, which is proportional to delta C. Okay, so is it clear? So to TC squared. So this is basically this comes from the interchain contribution to the internal energy of the system. So this thing is proportional to TC squared or delta C squared, since they are proportional at least in this mean field level. As a result, NS and delta C are proportional to each other. So NS here is the macroscopic superfluid density. And finally, when you look at the spectral function here, you get this delta function peak for the bound state, and then you have the continuum of multiparticle states shifted by the creation energy, basically, of these extra two charged solitons. So the distance here is twice the charge gap, which, as a result, once this picture is smeared by whatever disorder, coupling to nodal quasi-particles, whatever physics we left out of the analysis here, still one expects the distance between the peak and whatever dip develops here in the spectral function to scale with TC. Again, because this distance is given by delta C, which I argued is proportional to both delta C and the superfluid density. Okay. So, okay, I had one more thing to tell you, but I think I'll jump.
Well, it is a question.
Yeah, yeah, I'll conclude.
I get some coffee.
Yeah.
Well, there's TV cookies.
Yeah.
I mean, to get the spectral function above TC that smeared, you needed probably really strong interaction somehow. And those interactions, of course, could be so strong that they kill the superconductivity altogether and drive the crystallization of your, well, I guess it's a boson in each, the charged 2E boson in each chain. Presumably, I mean, that's a difficulty here, isn't it, to try to...
Matthew, is that true with the coupling you takes between the chains?
You probably can fine-tune the
Exactly.
I mean, who takes that coupling?
I mean, exactly. I mean, the point is that, I mean, even with the, I mean, it's not clear that the coupling that they took between the chains, namely the Johnson coupling or the pair hopping, is the most relevant one. Okay. Actually, it's not for the static system. I mean, it's easy to show. Well, any magnetic coupling is suppressed by the spin gap, but it's obvious that after a short calculation, it's obvious that the charge density correlations between strikes actually is more divergent or more divergent than the one that I choose to deal with. So you have to justify why this is the most relevant coupling. Okay, so this is a different subject, and there is work by Kibelson et al. That claims that once you introduce fluctuations into the problem, this is indeed the case. So fluctuations tend to decohere any charge density correlations that you might develop between the stripes, while actually enhancing the Johnson coupling. Just because the reason that, I mean, naively speaking, you have a better chance to have two of them close to each other. Okay. So, but this is an extra work needed in order to justify this particular choice of coupling between the stripes. Okay.
Do you want to comment on that extra work or not?
I may, but I mean, let me conclude first, maybe, and then we can decide. So, okay. Just if anybody is interested, we were trying to come up with an explanation for. Not only for this coherent peak appearing in the upper spectra, we also were interested in the possibility that this model might give us the neutron resonant peak, and the answer is that we couldn't find it. We did find some another magnetic resonance that I will be happy to describe for you, but since time is short, I would probably skip it. I mean, here I just listed its properties, and whoever is interested, I can tell you more about it later. So we couldn't find the pi resonant peak in this model, but it's not inconceivable that it's almost there in a sense that I might expand on later. So, instead of, you know, concluding and giving you a list of what I just told you, I'd like to leave you with these questions that, at least for me, are still open. Some of you probably noticed that I chose to march in the phase diagram along a line that goes in the underdoped region, rather than the optimally or even the overdoped region. And there is a good reason for that. Experimentally, at least, it's clear that stripe correlations are stronger in the underdoped region. What happens when you go into the overdoped region? How do these two descriptions match each other? I don't know. Apparently, LSCO is different. For example, no coherent peaks in the office data are seen there. is this a fundamental property or difference, or is it, are these just details? Just because it's, say, it's super free density is much smaller than, or so much smaller than BSCO. For example, when you go to very underdosed BSCO with TC of about 40, you don't see any coherent peaks in the office data as well. What is the mechanism for the Newton resonant peak in this model? I just told you that we looked for it, we couldn't find it, we found something else, and maybe we have a reason for believing that there is something like the Newton resonant peak there. And finally, how to get novel quasi-particles in this model. Actually, on this particular point, we do have new results, but I know that Steve is going to give a talk here, and I almost certain that he will address this point. So let me leave it at that. So thank you.